So, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the last of our quantum gravity sessions. A quick announcement before we start. I'll remind you that this afternoon for lunch, we have our beach barbecue at Goleta Beach. We'll tell you more about that later. It's basically you just walk that way down to the beach, everything will be obvious. But we do have a request that you please wear your name tag when you go to the beach barbecue. And the main point here, if you lost your name tag, if you don't have one, if you forgot it today, just checking with the folks out here, they'll give you a little temporary one, it's no problem. But the point is that when they get down there, it's the beach, there are a lot of people around, and the people serve with the catering servers want to know who they're allowed to hand out alcohol to. So, if you're going to be... No, probably, if you have a badge, they're going to assume you're over 21. That's probably true in this crowd. So if you don't want any beer, then maybe you can skip the name tag, but otherwise it's a good idea to get one. Okay. So that having been said, our first speaker today is going to be Carlo Rovelli from, I guess, Pittsburgh and Marseille, or Marseille and Pittsburgh. I'm not sure what it is. Everyone here, of course, knows Carlo, so he doesn't really need an introduction. But for the people listening via web, or who will be listening via web, let me mention that that Carlo is, of course, one of the founders of the Loop Quantum Gravity School. And he's also a well-known expositor on the problem of time and such things. And so he's probably the perfect person to tell us about dynamics in loop quantum gravity. Oh, Carlo also wanted me to mention that he was born in a small cottage outside of Verona. Beautiful spring day when the birds were singing and the fish were swimming. And
all right, thanks a lot. Okay. I will be talking about quantum gravity, loop quantum gravity, the non-perturbative approach to the quantization of general relativity. And in particular, I will concentrate on the dynamics. In a sense, I will skip all the first part, the kinematics. I will just say two very brief notes. A lot has been said about the kinematics by Abai yesterday and by John Baez. The talk is divided in two parts. The first part, I will describe the dynamics, where we are in the dynamics in the canonical formalism, which is the formalism in which the theory has originated. And, of course, there is no Hamiltonian, there is the dynamics is the two constraints, so I will describe the level at which the two constraints are understood, the construction and the definition of the two constraints. And I will show that a definition of the two constraints exists, and I will try to illustrate what is clear, what is not clear in the what is not yet clear in the theory. In the second part, I will shift to a different formalism, which is derived from the canonical formalism. I will shift to a space-time covariant formalism, because certain aspects of the theory are more clear in the space-time formalism. We are used to the fact that somehow the Lagrangian space-time formulation, it's physically more transparent, is easier to use when you are dealing with symmetries and so on and so forth, while on the other hand, the canonical formalism is where you resort to when you need to be precise and to understand exactly what is going on and how things are well-defined. So I will shift to the covariant formalism here, which is where a lot of activity has been going on in the last few years, and I will illustrate how this spin four formulation, which has been partly described by John Baez yesterday, is derived from the canonical formalism. And in a sense, part of my talk will overlap. There will be some overlaps with what John did, but the perspective is completely different here. I mean, John is a mathematician and can provide you what I cannot, a neat, clear, mathematically neat definition of spin form and what one can do with it. Here I am more interested in the physics and in what is it that forces us to go to this particular description of the quantum gravitational field, of the quantum space-time, the quantum gravitational fields in four dimensions. Okay. So let me start from the beginning. Actually, no. Let me start from a list of people who are... I'm not going to put names in the transparency, so here's a long list of people who have contributed to all that. Many, of course, are in the audience. Let me just point out that all this formulation in terms of spin networks, of spin forms, surfaces in space-time that capture the degrees of freedom of gravity, the first paper I know on that is by Junichi Iwasaki, I guess 10 years ago, something like that, in three dimensions. And it's really, I think, the place where the... Who is here? Where this particular formulation is born, as far as I understand. Completely independently, John Bites was thinking of a surface formulation of the theory, and Michael Reisenberger also. So all these ideas have been around for quite some time, even if the derivation from the quantum gravity formalism is a couple of years old. And then, of course, there's Pooling here, who has contributed a lot for solutions and understanding of the Hamiltonian, Marolf, and Lewandowski, who has done, his name should be in almost all my transparencies, and so on and so forth. Andrea Barbieri, who, as I will mention, was kind of instrumental in understanding the quantum geometry of this spin form in some way, and so on and so forth. So this is all for credit. And let me start from the beginning. And I said I'm talking about dynamics, but I'll start with kinematics, just to set a framework in which I'll be working from now on. So this is a single transparency. I summarize the construction of the Hilbert space in which everything lives, so to say. This is a short summary of 10 years of work on the construction of the Hilbert space and operators of quantum gravity. So the field is a SU2 connections on space for the moment. This is canonical. So it's an SU2 connection in a three-dimensional space that I take compact, smooth for the moment. And the states will be functionals, are functionals of the connection. And out of the states we want to make a Hilbert space. And of course, if this was not gravity, one would more or less be happy and go ahead and do theoretical physics, but here we have to be more careful. And this is quantum gravity. We want to characterize the space very cleanly and completely. So we pick a set of states which are dense in the linear space of continuous functional of the connection, and we choose a particularly convenient dense subspace, which are the states that can be written in terms of holonomies of the connection. So if we have a set of lines in the manifold, we can consider the holonomy of the connection along the line, and then, which is a group element, and then if we have a function of n group elements, we read it as a function of the holonomy along n lines, and we get a function of the connection. And these are the states we start from. On these states, there is a neat definition of a scalar product, which is can be shown to be nice and consistent, to be well defined. If we complete the linear space of finite combinations of these objects in this scalar product, we get a Hilbert space, and this is the environment on which everything is defined. Now, of course, a particular state in this Hilbert space is just the state formed by the holonomy around a single loop. These are the loop states. The loop states for a long time were used as a basis in this Hilbert space, but is an overcomplete basis. A non-overcomplete basis, a genuine basis, actually, a orthonormal basis, was found much later and is formed by the spin network states. So what the spin network states, again, we take the holonomy of the connection along some lines, and we take the matrix that represents that particular group element, which is holonomy, in a representation J. So we associate a representation of SU2, the spin, to each line. And then we get a bunch of matrices here. You can think indices here and there. So on any node, there are the three indices of the three representation that arrive at that node. And we put on any node a vector in the tensor product of the corresponding representation, which I call C, and we contract everything. And this gives a number. And this number, therefore, depends on the graph, the set of the lines, the representations, and this vector here, and this is what is called a spin network state. So this combination of things, the spin network, this is spin network state. Well, I skipped some details, but by appropriately choosing these vectors here, one can show that these spin network states form an orthonormal basis with respect to this scalar product here, so this Hilbert space here. So I will use a Dirac notation. I write these states as just S. S is a spin network, thinking of a Dirac notation of that sort. Of course, here S is a finite norm state. A is a generalized state in Dirac notation. More precisely, if the C sits, the C are vectors in the tensor product of the theory representation. If I decompose the tensor product into the irreducible representation of SU2 and I force C to be in the singlet, then this state is gauge invariant, and the resulting spin network states are span the gauge invariant part of the Hilbert space. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. This is a basis. On this Hilbert space, there are operators which are defined. This is analogous of the Fock space, if you want, for standard quantum field theory. There is analogous of creation and annihilation operators, which are function of the connection and its conjugate momentum, which is the triad, electric field of A. More precisely, there is no operator associated to the connection itself, but there is an operator associated to the holonomy of the connection. If I take the holonomy of the connection along the loop, I can clearly act on the states, just act by multiplication. And there is some kind of functional integral operator which correspond to the conjugate momentum. In terms of this functional this other operator, I can construct the area, because the area is a function of the triad, which is a conjugate of A. I can construct the volume, and so on and so forth, the results that both John and I referred to yesterday. So I have this Hilbert space with these operators with some attached and non-gauge invariant physical meaning, and some nice results about the spectra. Good. So that's all about the kinematics. Let me go to the dynamics. Now, before going to the dynamics, I'll leave the kinematics here as a reference. Just a small technical remark, and then I'll go into the actual construction of the two operators. The technical remarks is the following. The constraint, we want to solve the constraint. So find the eigenstate of the constraint with zero eigenvalue. The constraint has here a continuous spectrum. So its zero eigenvalues are actually generalized states, not finite norm states. So if you want, the volume of the gauge group is infinite. So when you want to solve away the gauge, you have these infinities that come in. And this is well known. One has to find a way to deal with generalized states. The simplest is to use a Gelfand triple technology. So this is the Hilbert space I'm talking about. I pick a dense subspace, which is well-behaved and regular, that sits inside here. And the natural thing to do is to take, since we have an orthonormal basis, to take.
So the first thing is the number zero is contained in the continuous spectrum.
Yes,
okay?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So here I pick finite linear combination of spin network states as a natural kind of nuclear space to define a Gelfand triple. And its algebraic dual is the generalized states, delta functions, and plane weights, and so on, on which H, of course, sits. And then if I have a constraint C that act on here, and therefore in particular on here, I define it by its dual action here, C sits here, But it's just a standard way in which it acts on the dual. The abuse of notation, I call it in the same way acting here or here. And of course, what I want is to solve this equation, C phi equals zero, which what I mean is that phi, the distribution, acting on C psi is equal zero, right? So this will, I wanted to make this clear because otherwise it becomes confusing later on. Let me go to the diffeomorphism. The diffeomorphism constraint is the curvature f of the connection times its electric field. And if I smear it with a, this is a one form, if this is an index, densitized one form, if I smear it against a vector field, I get a number here. This is the smeared diffeomorphism constraint. And of course, as I guess you all know, if you compute the Poisson bracket of anything with that, any gauge invariant, SE2 gauge invariant things with that, you get an infinitesimal diffeomorphism. So this generates diffeomorphism on the fixed time. So it's much more convenient to work with the group rather than the algebra. So we exponentiate the action of this symmetry group, and we consider a map phi from the three space to the three space, which it's traditional, and it's the reasons to take the this vector field here to be smooth, to be C infinity, and therefore to take this phi to be C infinity, namely to be an element of the diffeomorphism group. However, we're not really forced to restrict these maps to be C infinity, and there may be good reasons for not doing that, because here the field A, the connection, is smooth. But here, the Hilbert space is defined by completion with respect to the scalar product here. And it can be shown that when you take the completion, you take sequences of states like that. This is equivalent to taking functions of generalized connections, where a generalized connection is a connection with much less regularity condition, with a delta function and discontinuity and so on and so forth. So going to the quantum theory, we are really losing a lot of the regularity conditions of the classical fields, and so it's reasonable to be ready to extend the diffeomorphism to some more general, less regular transformation. At least, of course, it has to be continuous. So for the moment, let's think it's a diffeomorphism. A diffeomorphism acts on the connection, so therefore there is an action on the states. And the key property of this construction here is that this action, which is a linear action, is unitary. So the Hilbert space is actually carries a unitary representation of the diffeomorphism group. And what I want, solving the constraint, means to find the singlets under this action, so the states which are left invariant. But remember that I really want to solve this in the dual. So the states that I'm looking are those phi, which sits in this dual, this generalized state, which have to be such that a diffeomorphism that have the same value on a state and on a state acting on a diffeomorphism, and by linearity I can just restrict to the spin network basis state here. But it's a very simple calculation, which is rather obvious if you think for a moment, to see that a diffeomorphism acting on spin network states moves the connection around, which is the same thing as moving the spin network itself elsewhere in the manifold by the inverse diffeomorphism. So if I plug this inside here and I shift to a Dirac notation, I want to find a phi such that this equation is satisfied. Namely, I want to find a linear function on the space of the spin networks such that this linear function has the same value on any two spin networks connected by a diffeomorphism. And the solution of that is easy, and the complete solution is known. It's basically just a problem of giving the right definition. I define an S naught, which I indicate with lowercase s as opposite to the spin networks, which are indicated with capital S. And an S naught is an equivalence class of S under diffeomorphism. I'm skipping some technicalities here. So with this definition, I can define. So I want a phi that solves that equation, right? I'm shifting back and forth between the Dirac notation and the other notation. So I want a phi that solves that equation, and here it is. I'm defining it for each one of these S naughts. I define a phi in the obvious way. It's zero if the spin network is in this equivalence class. Is not in the equivalence class, is one if it is. And it's easy to see that this linear combination of those are the general solution of that equation. Okay. So I've solved the equation. What I have to find now is a scalar product on this space of solutions, which is not immediate because the solutions do not sit in the Hilbert space, but sits in a kind of larger dual. But there's a general technique for doing that. I take all observables in the Hilbert space, which are self-adjoint, so correspond to real classical quantities, and which commute with the action of the diffeomorphism group, which are invariant, and I require them to be self-adjoint in the scalar product to be defined over this solution space here, and this fixes the scalar product down here. And what it's rather easy to see that it fixes it to be it fixes those states to be orthogonal to each other. So this is different from zero only if it's the same state. And the norm of this state is not one, but is a this requirement fixes it to be a integer which is related to the number of symmetries, the number of discrete symmetries of the S naught that can be obtained by diffeomorphism. These are some technicalities, but I mention it because they were missed in the first solutions of this equation. Sorry? Yeah, sure. I'm sorry? Jim asked whether by observable here in this context I mean something that commutes with the diffeomorphism constraint only, and the answer was yes. I should say better operator, grounding operator. Okay, so what are these S naughts? Well, this, as I said, are equivalence class of spin network under diff, so are spin networks up to arbitrary deformations, so to say combinatorial spin networks, which are given by some combinatorial quantity graph, and of course the representation and the vectors here. Now here we have two options at this point, because it seems that at first sight that I've defined a Hilbert space with a nice discrete basis. It seems that the equivalence classes of these graphs, with some labeling over it, but essentially these graphs under diffeomorphism form a discrete set. Right, not discrete sets. But they're not. For some kind of curious reason, which I just want to illustrate, which is the following. If you think, take R3 and take straight lines through the origin in R3, okay? And take the action of the linear group, GL3, the linear transformation on R3. Now, if you have the space of one straight line to the origin, and you act with linear transformation, you can basically transform any line, any straight line in any other straight line. So if you take the space of the line and you divide it by the action of the group, you get a discrete space. It's a point. If you have two lines, you divide by the action of the group, the same. If you have three, four, the same, because with a linear transformation, you can always say take one line like that, one like that, and then a linear transformation, one just 45 degrees. But if you have five lines, it doesn't work anymore. Because the angle of the fifth in that particular basis is just, you have no more parameters in the linear group to act on it. So once you have understood that, you realize that if you have a node of a spin network with five valid nodes, with five things coming out, with five tangents, a diffeomorphism act on that space as a linear transformation. So when you divide by the diffeomorphism, you get a moduli space. You get one extra parameter that cannot be killed by the diffeomorphism. So therefore, you get, for five valence or more vertices, you get states which are orthogonal, because they are different S-naughts, and which are labeled by a continuous parameter. Okay? Therefore, when you do this division, there is this pathology, so the Hilbert space you get is non-separable. This is the non-separability of the Hilbert space of diffeomorphic invariant states that sometimes people refer to. Now, all these moduli spaces have been studied, computed, their dimension, there have been some works. Now, there are two options in defining the theory. One is to say, well, n here has to be say infinity, what I really have to divide to is the diffeomorphism, and then you end down to this non-separable Hilbert space. The other option is to relax this regularity condition on n, namely on phi, and to require the states to be invariant under a bigger group, okay? And in particular, you can just go all the way down to continuous things, and then you kill this extra moduli, and you get a separable Hilbert space, and that, I think, is the correct thing to do.
Can I just mention, we can talk about this more later, but continuous transformations don't really act on that space spin networks that we've been talking about. We can talk about it later.
They act, well the good of having
it's
a...
So easier.
Yes, but the good of having a mathematician friend is it always tells you what is wrong and what you do, and then 5 months later it tells you what the right way is doing that. So I'm very happy with it. Okay, so let me go down to the physical interpretation of this abstract state, which is the following. Now, you remember that when you have when you study the volume operator, it gets contribution for the node of the spin network. This blue thing is a piece of a spin network. So there is one can think there is a quantum of volume around the node, and two nodes are separated by a link, and the corresponding two little volumes are separated by a little surface, and the area of this surface depends on the coloring of this link. So one can view a spin network like a bunch of little quanta of volume and a bunch of little quanta of surface. What has happened by dividing by the diffeomorphism is that the spin network is not sitting on the space anymore, so we're not giving area and volume to the original manifold, but this, so to say, sits nowhere. There's no space on which this is. This is space, so we view this as a quantum excitation of space itself, and not a quantum excitation in space. In other words, we cannot say where these things are, but we can say where something is with respect to these things. And this is a characterizing aspect of this theory. Here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's a simple calculation. It's phi, it's a map from the space to the space. So you view it as something that takes any point in the space to any other point of the space. So it takes the spin network and moves it to the spin network.
So just moves it?
Yeah, just moves it and does nothing to the coloring. Yes, correct. Yes, correct. And this is the result of calculating what happens just by this. Yeah. Okay. So that's all for the diffeomorphism constraint. Let me go to the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay, so I'm just describing the diffeomorphism constraint and going to the Hamiltonian constraint. And the Hamiltonian constraint, I've written it there, is the curvature of the connection times the electric field twice. And that's the standard form of the Hamiltonian constraint. There's been a long struggle with this expression, which was enormously simplified when this expression was replaced by this expression here. Of course, the constraint is this equal to zero, so you can free of charge multiplied by any function of the variables. Q is the square of E, so this is really the determinant of E.
So the SAE is the curvature of the SU2 connection.
Right, correct.
But in the real connection parameter.
Yes. I'm working with the real connection, and this is the constraint that defines the Euclidean theory. I'll say something about the Lorentzian later, the Hubble's transparency. What's the problem with this expression? This is a density, this is a density. So this is actually a double density, which from the point of view of geometry is an horror. It's a horror. This is a single density, which is the right thing from the point of view of geometry. It's a three form. It's the right thing that you want to integrate. What we're interested in is the integrals of that. Okay? So what you integrate is three forms. So if you want to be rigorous about the geometry, you have to work with things that transform decently, and that's the object that transforms decently. The reason this was not considered is because there is square root, inverse square root, which seems to be very difficult thing to do in the quantum theory. But observe that if I take the volume of a region, and I take the connection in a point, and I compute the Poisson bracket of the two, I get precisely EE with epsilon ABC anti-symmetrized, but AB is anti-symmetric, so I can insert an epsilon here, free of charge, divided by square root of Q. So the Hamiltonian can be nicely rewritten using the Poisson bracket in this form here. Now this form, so this is the form I want to start with to go to the quantum theory, and first I want to regularize this expression, because as I said, there is no operator corresponding to the connection itself, and even less to its curvature, but only to holonomies. So I have to regularize this thing, kind of point split, and a relatively decent way of doing that, preserving as much symmetry as I can, is the following. I introduce a triangulation of the manifold with a parameter epsilon, which is roughly how fine is this triangulation. And I replace the curvature with the holonomy around a little triangle here. Of course, the holonomy around a closed loop to first order in epsilon, to second order, to appropriate order in epsilon is the curvature, last correction. And then I replace A with the holonomy again, and then to keep gauge symmetry, I put another holonomy. I write an expression here, which is such that in the limit epsilon goes to zero, goes to that. And of course, there is a lot of freedom in writing expression of that sort. There is a lot of possibilities that other alternatives could have been chosen. But I choose this one, and from here I write a quantum operator that in the classical limit gives that, and the quantum operator is just written here. It's basically obtained by replacing quantities with their corresponding operator, and also by replacing Poisson bracket with the commutator. Okay? So that's a key idea in the quantization. The volume, we know the volume operator, and the holonomy, we know the holonomy as functions of the connection, it acts that my multiplication is easy. So here I have a nice operator, regularized Hamiltonian. And of course, remember, again, that what I really want is the thing acting on the dual, right? So the operator I'm interested is this one, not this one, which again, by Abelian notation, I write the same way, is the operator acting on the dual. Which is defined in the following way, and it is this operator here that I have to take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. Okay? Now, any minimal experience with this kind of calculation will tell you that you get any sort of divergences when you take this limit, you get all the divergences of quantum field theory back. That's exactly where you expect all the divergences to come back, because you bring the points together, this is all the dynamics and so on. So the good news, and I would say the core of the entire construction, is the observation that when you take epsilon to zero, you get a finite operator, in the sense that I'll say in a moment, provided that you only act on the diffeomorphic invariant state. Okay. So, the statement is the following. Remember that H is actually acts inside. So, the limit as epsilon goes to zero of phi, okay, acting on H, this H defined here, on a spin, on a spin network state, not an S node, spin network state. Okay, this is a number, right? Because this is a dual acting on state. This number is finite, sorry, this limit exists and is finite. Okay. Provided that C is diffeomorphically invariant, is one of the S null states. Yes?
Sorry, what is epsilon? I mean, I thought you don't have distances here.
No, no, I do have distances here. Sorry, my notation is this is capital S. This is capital S. This is capital S. C will be diffeomorphism invariant.
Okay. Embedded in space, and you don't really have metrics, but you can talk about the sort of limit.
It's a coordinate distance, yes, 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 absolutely, yes.
Does the Hamiltonian, when acting on a diffeomorphism invariant state, give you a diffeomorphism invariant state?
Maybe that question is repeated.
Yeah. Which one? This object here? No.
No.
No. I'll get. We can discuss that later. Exactly. We get deeply into technicalities here, so I'm happy to come back to that.
How do you see the difference between, you know, let's say H epsilon and H half epsilon? You know, because by diffeomorphisms, you could presumably, coordinate expand your space.
It's precisely when this is invariant, when this is diffeomorphic invariant, it doesn't matter anymore. Just hold for the next. The answer is yes. So let me just say what you're saying. That is what is being discussed here. Okay, so let me illustrate what is the action of this operator on a phi, and let me choose a phi which is an S naught state. This is the diff invariant one. Okay, and so the what it does is written here. First of all, acting on one of these states, it breaks down in the sum of terms on one per each node of little s, and that's not surprising. Because there's a volume here, and the volume is zero unless when it sees a node. Okay, so it gives zero everywhere except in the points where there is a node. So there is a sum of terms, one per each node, and on a node, this is a piece of the spin network, of the abstract spin network. On a node, the way it acts is the following. It does nothing to the rest of the spin network around, and it replaces, it opens up these nodes in three nodes. This is a particular action on a trivalent node. There are similar formulas for high valid node. So it opens up in a triangle, so there are extra colors here, and it multiplies by some coefficients that depend on the spins, on the previous spins, and on the new spins, and these coefficients can be computed explicitly from the definition and have been computed explicitly known. Now, key point. Why this formula holds? Because when this operator here, acts on a spin network state, which this is an embedded spin network, right? What it does... Let's concentrate on this holonomy here. This holonomy here essentially multiplies by the holonomy of this triangle. So it adds a triangle here, right? The size of this triangle is epsilon. But when I act with a dual state here, this dual state knows nothing about embedding. So if this dual state is that, it gives 1 irrespectively of the size of epsilon here. So for epsilon equals 0, I get every sort of zeros and divergences infinity. But when I approach, when epsilon is different from 0, I get a limit which is independent from epsilon. Okay. That's the point that you're making. So it's really diffeomorphism invariant that leads to finiteness. The finiteness of the Hamiltonian constraint operator is really due to diffeomorphism invariant. Now, some brief comments about the Hamiltonian. First of all, there are no anomalies. Second, so the constraint algebra closes. Some exact solutions are known, a large class or, well, a class, which I'm not saying whether it's large or not. What I've discussed is the Laurent is the Euclidean constraint. If I want with a real connection to do the Laurentian theory, I have another piece of the constraint, which has also been defined, and it acts in a similar way, and the same thing happened. I'm not describing it. Young-Mills theory, fermions coupled to generativity have a longer Hamiltonian constraint. This has been constructed, so the kinematics and the dynamics theory has been constructed, and it's still finite exactly the same way. In green, the less pleasant aspect of the construction. The construction is far from unique. There are ambiguities in the regularization, there are ambiguities in the details of the construction of the operator, there are a number of variants, can be symmetrized, not symmetrized, the little triangle can be put in a different way, there are various things that one can change. So the question is that, are these ambiguities kind of different quantum theory with the same classical limit, do they give the correct classical limit? Is there a way to compute explicitly the classical limit of this theory? The answer is no. There have been two sorts of doubts relating to this construction. One refers to what has been perceived as kind of excessive locality of this action. If you have a big spin network, somehow it seems to act piece by piece and not mixing different parts of the spin network. I'm just giving an impressionistic idea of the worry that this operator has been raising. And the other is that it's true that there are no anomalies, but there are kind of too many no anomalies. The classical Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints is a diffeomorphic constraint. The quantum commutator of two such Hamiltonian constraints is zero. Now, to first sight, one says, well, of course, because this is only defined on diffeomorphic invariant things. But then an extension of this operator has been constructed that makes sense on non-diffeomorphic invariant things, and it's still zero, so there's ongoing discussion of what is really the meaning of this zero, and there are different opinions inside the community. One opinion being this zero is a sign that something is missing, the other opinion is that there's no problem. The key point is whether or not this zero indicates that whether or not the classical limit is right and the solution is not known. In any case, this diffeomorphic constraint, this Hamiltonian constraint, in one or the other of the variants, define a finite, background independent, and general covariant quantum field theory in four dimensions, whether it's classical generativity or not, I don't know. Now, I'm a little bit late with time with respect to what I have planned, so I will go faster now. And I'm going to the second part of the talk, which is the spin form formulation. So, this is stuff which is all more recent. And the point is to go from a canonical to a covariant description. Following the idea here is to following what Feynman did when he started doing covariant space-time quantum mechanics in his PhD thesis. We have the space of the F-naught, so the space of diffeomorphic invariant states, and we have the Hamiltonian constraint. We solve, we get the space of physical states. Okay, we have this constraint defined. Of course, we know little about that because we know very little about the general solution of this thing. So we can, change gear and work much more as a physicist and much less as a relativist. Sorry. Can we take the tape back? And just forget the infinities, forget the generalized states and so on, and imagine that there is view this as a subspace of the space, actually enlargement of the space. So there's a operator that projects me to this space of solution, which roughly is the delta function of the Hamiltonian, right? Now, as is commonly done in functional integral formulation of field theory, quantum field theory, I can express the delta function in terms of an integral and write this projection as an integral of a smearing functions of the exponential of the constraint, right? That's what you do in functional integral, for instance, when you have a Lagrange multiplier, the functional integration of the Lagrange multiplier gives you a delta function of the constraint. Let me take this expression, which is by itself is not well-defined, seriously, and expand it There is the n integrals that can be nicely dealt with and can be performed, and the matrix element of this projector between two S naught states are expanded in a sum, which this is the first term. The second term has a Hamiltonian, the action of Hamiltonian. Actually, this is the sum of the action on all the nodes here and so on. Then a bunch of terms with two Hamiltonians and so on. Now, the key point is that this series admits a graphical representation. This is really Feynmanology, as follows. So the first term, I write it as follows. First term is different from zero only if S is equal to S prime, right? So I write it as follows. I write S prime, and I imagine a surface that connects the two by taking S moving up to S prime, okay? And this is the world sheet of this motion is a surface. It's a two-dimensional surface made by three little surfaces corresponding to the three edges, to the three links here, that are attached together. Now I want to give a graphical representation of this sort of terms here. And so now S and S primes are different, okay? And remember that the action of the Hamiltonian take this node and open up this way. So I move the first spin network up. I act with Hamiltonian by opening up this node in three, okay? And I get a little vertex, which is this one, and then I get the second spin network, and so on. I can do everything. To each of these terms, there is this expansion is can be computed, right? This is term by term, everything is finite and well defined. So to each of this term, I have an amplitude, a corresponding number, and this number is basically the matrix element of the Hamiltonian. So that expression, that matrix element, can be written as a sum over all these pictures of an amplitude for each picture, and the amplitude is a product of the vertices in the picture, which is the matrix element of the Hamiltonian. So what are these pictures exactly? Spin networks that John has neatly defined yesterday. They're faces that meet along edges, and this in turn the edges meet in vertices, and the edges comes up with the spin that was attached to the link. So the faces have a C2 representation, and the edges come up with the intertwiners, with the vectors, which sit on the node of the spin network. So these are precisely the objects that John was describing yesterday. And there is a rule for calculating these amplitudes. Okay, this is a formula which is finite, term by term, and this sum. Everything is computable. And the amplitude is the matrix element of the Hamiltonian between the up spin network and the down spin network. And notice that if I complete the spin network here, the value of this matrix element does not depend on the rest of the spin network. This is locality in this game. It's a property of the Hamiltonian that it acts piece by piece. So this expression does not depend on the rest of the Hamiltonian. This is... This is the action on a trivalent node. On a four-valent node, I get more complicated action and more complicated vertices that in principle can be computed, and everything can be computed. Now, so I get this cute expression, which I leave here for a while. And the rest of the talk, I have only 5 minutes, I'm going to illustrate how should we read this. The first thing I'm going to do is to remind you that what we're doing, at least the way I perceive what we're doing, we're really making precise what Will-o'-the-Wheat on the one hand and Stephen Hawking in his school, and Hartle and Jim Hartle and so on, on the other hand, in the space-time formalists have been doing for some time. So in the Hartle-Hawking point of view, I have a four-dimensional manifold bounded by three-dimensional spaces. I have three metric here, four metric here. The state is an amplitude to the three metrics, so I can write it this way. And I can associate to this picture here a propagator, which is actually a projector, from this state here and this state here, which is defined as the functional integral over four geometries of the exponential of the Euclidean action, where the functional integral, the four geometries are bounded by this given three geometries, and I can go through a computation, a formal computation, because I don't know about this measure, because that's not all defined, and the formal calculation tells me that the, if I start from any psi tilde state down here, and I propagate up there, I end up with a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, right? This is a well-known calculation that you find in the Euclidean quantum gravity books. Here is exactly the same thing, right? So I have state here, so the three metric is replaced by the spin network and the four metrics by the spin form, and I have a propagator, which is given by the sum over the spin forms, so there's quantized four geometries that are bounded by the correct spin networks, and this is the exponent of a sum, so it's a product for every point of some amplitude, and this is a product of the vertices only of some amplitude of the vertex. And of course, I can use a functional notation to capture the entire theory in an integral here and to capture the entire theory in a sum there. Now, this gives me some intuition about that expression here, right? I'm really doing four-dimensional sum over histories of quantized histories of the quantum gravitational field. Now, two things. First, how does this help me physically? And second, why metrics are replaced by these discrete things? So first of all, how does this help me physically? Suppose I want to compute observables and do some physics. If I'm doing the canonical formalism, I have to do complicated stuff, writing everything in terms of the initial phase space, which in principle I know how to do it, but in practice I have to know a lot about the solution of the equation of motion in order to do that. I'm not going through that in details. I just want to make a point that is always notoriously complicated to work in the canonical formalism, to do physics. In the covariant formalism, I have a nice sum of histories, formulation of the quantum mechanics of the theory. Okay, so I can forget all the rest and just take a way of looking at quantum mechanics, and in particular, for instance, Jim Hartle's way of looking at quantum mechanics, that tells me how to read this, how to extract numbers from it. And to do Hartle's quantum mechanics, I need the fine-grained histories, I need the coarse-grained histories, this is my observable, so to say, and I need the coherence function. But I can compute the coherence function if I have an amplitude for each fine-grained history, and here I have, because the fine histories are the spin forms. The coarse-grained histories are any property, any almost invariant properties of the four geometry. So anything that you can ask in classical generativity is a property of the four geometry, so something that you can represent as a partition of the set of four geometry for spin forms, and the amplitude is what I just described before. So I am in a setting now in which it's easier to do physics. Why, last question, why the metric have been replaced with these discrete things? Let me discuss that with a little bit of history, something which is kind of completely independent evolution that leads to the same picture, and this I think will clarify this discretization. Remember Regge calculus, in which I introduce a discretization and a triangulation, and I replace the metric with the length of the links of the Regge calculus. Now, at the end of the 60s, Ponsano and Regge define the Pontano-Regge model as follows, by taking Regge calculus in three dimensions and by putting an ansatz. The ansatz, just completely non-justified at that point, is that the length of these lines is a half integer in natural units. So it's a spin. If I do that, then the exponential e to the action, with some technicalities, has a very simple expression, which is, so you take a piece of space-time, which is three-dimensional, which is a tetrahedron. You have six four integers, half integers. Out of six half integers, you can compute the 6J symbol, which is what John yesterday called the spin network evaluation of this picture, of this spin network here. And the exponential of the Einstein-Hilbert action is just the 6J symbol. So you take the product of all the tetrahedra. So they proposed a formula for quantum gravity, which is just the sum over all the coloring of the product of all the tetrahedra of the 6J symbol. It's quite similar to that one. Now, this formula has divergences, but dealing physicist way with divergences, one can show that does not depend on the triangulation chosen. Now, several years later, Turayev and Viro, in a very celebrated work, basically took this model, replaced SU2 with quantum SU2, and proved that the sum is finite, it's really triangulation independent, and it defines a topological quantum field theory in the sense of Atiyah. So there is a topological quantum field theory hidden here. It means that there are Hilbert spaces attached to two-dimensional things and so on. So how does this work? This is a three-dimensional space. This is topological quantum field theory. I need to construct a Hilbert space here. How do I construct a Hilbert space here, starting with labeled triangulations? Well, I take the space, that's not my final thing, I take the space which has as basis the possible colorings of this triangulation, but that's too big, and I project out of this Hilbert space a physical Hilbert space, okay, with a projector which is exactly the 2i0, the Pontano-Regge sum. So I construct a projector given a state here, namely a coloring here, a coloring here. I sum over all possible colorings inside the product of the tetrahedra 6J symbol. This defines a quantum field theory in the sense of Atiyah. Not only a quantum field theory of the sense of Atiyah, but this defines precisely three-dimensional quantum gravity as it was had already at the time been constructed by Witten and was constructed in the loop representation as well, and so on. So what is the relation between this Hilbert space and its projection and a canonical quantization of three-dimensional quantum gravity? A canonical quantization on this two-dimensional space, I have a connection, and I start from a little space which are functions of the connection. Now there is a map from this Hilbert space to this Hilbert space, which was constructed by Uguri in 92, as follows. Take the triangulation of the Pontano, Regge, Turev, and Viro. Take the dual of the triangulation, it was nicely described by John yesterday. And on the dual, well, I can go through a complicated description, but basically take the spin network state of A corresponding to the dual. The dual has labelings here, representations, from the labelings of the triangulation. This is precisely the right map, and then the constraints and everything combine so that when you impose the constraint, you basically go down to that Hilbert space, physical Hilbert space there. So that starts to clarify things, but much more clarifying is the following observation. So the states here are precisely spin network states of loop quantum gravity, but now take one of the spin network states and ask what is the length of the edges of the triangulation up there. Well, this is a quantum state. We know loop quantum gravity. We know how to compute length. It turns out... Okay, can I have 1 minute, 2 minutes? It turns out that this state here is an eigenstate of the Lang operator, and the eigenvalues is discrete in half integers. So the Pontano-Regge ansatz is not just an ansatz coming down from the sky. It's a result of the quantization of length. And when Pontano and Regge take these half integers, they are not summing over some arbitrary chosen subset of classical configuration. They are summing over a basis in the Hilbert space of the theory. They're putting kind of a completion of a basis in the space of the theory, and this basis is the eigenbasis of the length. Okay? So, I think this starts, if I wanted to do Hartle-Hawking rigorously, I want to replace this sum over intermediate four geometries with something well-defined, I do it in the quantum theory by summing of intermediate states. And intermediate states are eigenstates of a complete set of operators, and that's what a spin form is. Now, this is in three dimensions. Everything is clear, nice and clear. in four dimensions, can I do the same? Well, I can take the same kind of BF theory that was described yesterday by John in four dimensions, and the key point is that instead of having discrete length, I have to have discrete areas. Okay? This was rather mysterious when happened, from the point of view of the loop representation is obvious, because this is the quantized basis in two-dimensional space, this is a quantized, naturally quantized object in three-dimensional space, that's the basis. But of course, this is BF theory. To do general relativity, I need to do the analogous sum, but to remember that B is actually EE. So I have to take the analogous of the Pompano-Regge model in four dimensions, which is the Ogui-Kleinietter model, and modify it by imposing that B is equal EE. If one does that, one has a again an expression like the Pompano-Regge one, where however the amplitude is modified to take this into account, and there is a beautiful interpretation of this modification, which I'll skip because I don't have time. which leads me to this model, which is the Barrett-Klein model that John referred to, in which I have a triangulation. I have the standard SE2 representation, and I have the kind of the analogous of the Pompano-Regge in four dimensions, but corrected to take gravity into account. Now, this is a triangulation, but now there is a key observation. This expression does not really depend on the triangulation, depend on less. Depends only on the 4, 3, and 2 simplices of the triangulation, but not on the 2 and 1 simplices of the triangulation. And this is why the Kleinietter theory is not a good topological invariant, because it misses the... well. So, let me take this expression written in terms of triangulation and go to the dual. That's the trick that we have described works. We take the 4 simplices, and the dual is a vertex, the tetrahedron is an edge, the triangle is a surface. So the colored things turn out to be edges and surfaces, and the amplitude is on the vertex. So what we get is that this is translated in the dual pictures precisely in this sum here. It's a sum of a spin form of the product of vertices. So the Barrett-Klein theory is exactly an expression of this kind with the same spin form, the same expression, just a different value of the vertices. Finally, and that's the last.
Maybe, yes.
Okay, so...
We didn't just say time to the kids.
Okay, so let me just...
Two slides at once.
Put this here. Of what I've not said. So I want to make one last point, which is the following. There is a farther way of getting exactly the same expression, which is the this sum with spin form, which is the following. All these models, like the Kleinietter and the Tourette-Virou, actually derived from the matrix models, which were the way of doing non-perturbative string theory 10 years ago, I guess. So there, one constructs space-time as a Feynman expansion of a quantum theory of matrices. Now, Bulatov tried to do the same thing for three dimension and succeeded, starting from a field theory over three copies of SO3. And Oguri did the same thing over with a field theory on four copies of SO4, whose graphical Feynman graph expansion gives precisely the Kleinietter theory, okay, the quantum BF in four dimensions. If I go from here to general relativity, I have to do a certain restriction on the Kleinietter sum. It turns out that this restriction can be expressed on the field theory itself by simply restricting the field, which is a function of SO4, to be invariant under the orbits of a S3 subgroup of SO4, namely to be a function of four copies of the 3 sphere. So, if I take a field which is a function of four copies of the 3 sphere, with this action here, first term as this structure, the second term as this structure, I do a Feynman expansion, I get again a sum of spin forms with all the right coefficients, all the right things, and an amplitude which is precisely the Barrett-Crane amplitude. So there is a lot of directions which all converge to this formulation, this expression, which is a sum over spin forms, product of amplitudes. The only difference is between is the value of this amplitude. So that's the end. That's really the end. That's the summary. I'm sorry, I took more than. So I just summarized by reading this. First, as far as the canonical theory is concerned, in my understanding, there are a lot of things to be understood, a lot of variants, but there exists a tentative theory of quantum gravity in four dimensions, which is generally covariant and background independent, with holes, with missing things, things not understood, but there is something to be studied here. Second, the dynamics appear to be finite, better than one expected, thanks to different variants. The several variants of the theory, the classical limit is not understood, and we don't know how to do general computation. What I see as a promising direction to investigate this theory is to go to a space-time formalism with a spin form. This can be obtained by expanding the projector on the physical state, and this spin form formulation, it's can be viewed as a well-defined version of the Hawking integrals. It's exactly the same kind of expression that emerges from taking topological quantum field theory and modifying it to get general relativity. It also emerges from trying to extend to four dimension the idea of the two-dimensional matrix models. It admits a nice, clean physical interpretation using Hartle quantum mechanics, and it gives us a picture of Wheeler space-time form, so to say, namely a quantum space-time. Thank you.
Talks, and I have the question about the final punchline of the first one. You construct it a super-Hamiltonian, which is finite when acting on diffeomorphism invariant states. You told us that it can be extended in such a way that it is also finite when acting on non-diffeomorphism invariant states. Now, you have the commutation relations of those super-Hamiltonians, which give you zero, the Aberian algebra. And you mentioned that there are different opinions about how bad or acceptable this is. What I would like to ask you is that you give me an opinion about how bad or good it is from your standpoint, and also because there are many people here who worked on the similar problem, I would like ask them what is their estimate how bad or good it is. And in particular, one would like to recover the ordinary classical general relativity in some limit in which the super-Hamiltonians would have the commutation relations, well, would have the Poisson bracket relations, where there isn't zero on the right-hand side of the equation. Otherwise, it wouldn't be classical general relativity. Does anyone have any idea how from those operators which gives zero in quantum theory to construct in the classical limit the classical super-Hamiltonians which wouldn't give zero?
Okay. I'll let you respond first, and I'm sure other people in the audience want to add their comments.
Do we want to start?
With you.
Oh, with me?
Since Carl asked for your opinion first.
My own point of view is the following. There is a well-posed mathematical problem here in roughly. Well, there's a physically well-posed problem, namely whether the theory defined by that particular Hamiltonian is the gives classical generativity in the limit or not. I think this is an interesting problem, and the interesting problem is not whether something else should make us suspect that the answer to this problem is yes or no. So this is the interesting problem. What I think the theory should recover is, or what I expect the theory should recover is the gauge invariant, the coordinate invariant aspect of generativity. I would not be surprised at all if the quantum theory that can be defined along that particular path only gives us the diffeomorphic invariant observables in GR. So for this reason, my own point of view is that unless I see a theorem telling me that because of that particular zero, certainly the classical limit is not going to work, I don't think this is a serious problem at all. On the other hand, that's first answer. The second answer is that the Hamiltonian exists in a number of variants, and there is a number of other variants that have been mentioned that have not been explored, that have not been completely studied. So I don't think it's worthwhile studying a particular variant when instinctively I suppose that maybe other variants could be interesting.
Well, you mean the other variants would give you the same commutation relations with zero, or would give you something else?
I expect that there might be variants that will give something else, but I don't know, because there are a lot of variants that have not been explored yet.
Do you feel that the Hamiltonians that you studied, the variants that people studied until now, that one of them is the correct one, and that you can recover the classical limit out of them?
Yes, I do, but I don't think it's particularly interesting what we feel. I think. You see, I tell you what I feel. I feel like I've been in this game for a while, walking in the forest and going ahead and trying to get somewhere. And of course, there are many possibilities that this is not going to work for some reason or the other. I think it's interesting to explore and go ahead in the hope that this might work, rather than concentrating on the reason of fear. There are hundreds of reasons of fear, and I'm aware of them, and I keep going ahead and hoping that we'll get the theory. That's a theory. The problem now is to understand whether its classical limit is right, and I think one way of understanding whether the classical limit is right is to go to this covariant formulation. This will help us understanding whether that particular Hamiltonian might work, or may suggest us modification to that particular Hamiltonian, or something else. I don't know. Then a technical point, somebody can answer better than me. I don't think that the extension, because that's not my work, the extension of the Hamiltonian has been, I don't think the Hamiltonian has been extended to all generic non-diffeomorphic invariant states, has been extended to some class of non-diffeomorphic invariant states. But
right. The technical statement is it has been extended to a class of states which are not diffeomorphic invariant, which are not the generic class of non-diffeomorphic invariant states, but it's a big enough class on which the diffeomorphic group acts non-trivially. There's no element of the diffeomorphic group which is trivially represented on that space.
Right.
Right.
So it's... I feel that my point of view is that if somebody's strongly scared by this zero, I can work on something else, but it's not scaring me sufficiently for working on something else.
Okay. So I have your opinion. Now, there are many people who work on this,
I will get back to Bob and Jim, or Gary. Okay. I assume your questions are on different subjects, but I'll get back to you in a minute. I think Abai wants to comment on this.
When this result first came about that these Hamiltonian constraint operators actually commute, I thought that meant clearly that this is wrong, and that in a way I was excited because I thought that would tell us what we are to change. Whenever you are stuck against the wall, you learn new things, and I thought one would learn new things. But then I was disappointed because I said, well, okay, let's look at 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, where we know the full answer and we know the theory, and can we get, what happens there? Do we get completely something wrong here? And what happens, so In order to have a really good test, what one should do is not just solve 2 plus 1 gravity some other way, but to take these constructions which were given to us by Thomas Tiemann, basically, which is the thing that you're referring to, and there and carry them out step by step and see what happens in that case. And in particular, is it true that in the ensemble of solutions you would get, you have, by following the procedure step by step, so to say, you have the semi-classical states that one knows from other constructions. And then it turns out that indeed, the solution space is huge, there are lots of solutions, but the semi-classical states do arise. They are not the simplest states that you could have written down. They involve infinite superpositions of the simple states that Tiemann wrote down, for example, but infinite superpositions which are convergent in a very well-defined sense. And in fact, you recover all the semi-classical states can be recovered by following step-by-step the Tiemann construction. But by that I mean all the semi-classical solutions are recovered. Of course, on the solution space, there is no constraint algebra to check, anything like that. So at the moment, this was a bit of a surprise to me. Then I also looked at some, model systems and so on and so forth. And unfortunately, I think just the validity or non-validity of the constraint algebra is not as strong a requirement of getting good semi-classic limits as I had originally hoped. So I think it is quite possible that even with I'm not saying that it's true, but it is not, there's no obstruction, I can see, that even with the existing Hamiltonian, with the existing procedure that Tiemann has given us, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, there may exist lots of semi-classical states. But I think this is the crux of the problem, and this is where a lot of the concentrated effort hopefully will go in, and should go in.
So data, I guess, you are answering correctly that the semi-classical limit question was worked out completely in 2 plus 1 gravity.
Yeah, maybe I could just add a technical clarification here, that I think one of the things Abai meant when he said that the semi-classical states solve the Tiemann constraints in 2 plus 1 is that, in fact, if you look at a standard quantization of pure 2 plus 1 gravity a la Witten or something of that kind, then all the entire Witten 2 plus 1 Hilbert space does satisfy the Tiemann constraints. That's basically the technical
point. Slightly more than that, one can actually obtain them by following the step-by-step procedure which was given to us by Thomas Tiemann. Logically, it is exactly what you said, but
the statement is that one can obtain the Witten sort of Hilbert space as a preferred space of states.
The Witten Hilbert space is contained. Now, those you follow step by step this procedure, the Witten Hilbert space is contained, but one needs an external input into the whole program in order to select out this as these particular states, and that external input is really the inner product on the space of states. In other words, if you externally impose the inner product and say, out of all the ensemble of states that one has, Tiemann has given us, find the ones which are finite norm with respect to this inner product. And this inner product was not suggested directly by any of the things that Thomas has done, but I'm putting it as an external input. Then one does get all the states in the Witten theory. And this inner product step, of course, is missing in the 3 plus 1 theory.
And is that also true that in this 2 plus 1 case, the Hamiltonian constraints commute?
Yeah.
Yes. Carl seems to have a further question over here.
Okay. I am still confused about that answer with the inner product. You have the inner product, right, in the 3 plus 1 construction. This is a different one that you are talking about, or this is an inner product on what states?
The inner product you need is the space of solutions to all constraints. I don't think we have obviously deliverable and clear inner product in 3 plus 1 theory on the space of solutions to all constraints. One could write down inner product. But I don't know that there is a believable inner product that which is clearly correct or something.
Maybe there are other questions also.
I think there are probably other questions that we could move on to. I'm sure you two will discuss this for a long time throughout the day. Okay.
Yeah. Well, this is actually somewhat of a question to clarify some things that were just discuss. I mean, are you claiming that there are, in this Hilbert space that you've constructed that satisfies the diffeomorphism constraint, you know, going to this dual, there are normalized states that satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint? I mean, this goes to the question of is that what is the inner product? I mean, if you don't have to, if you stay, just go to a subspace of that Hilbert space, then you have the inner product.
Well, the technical answer is yes, there are some, but this is not a satisfactory answer because I suppose the special ones that we know do are a certain small class, which I don't think represent the generic states. So I expect the generic solution of the Hamiltonian constraint is not a finite norm state in that Hilbert space you're referring to.
So does one, so what do you expect? I mean, that you would have to, that could you, do you expect to be able to do a similar construction of going to this dual again and
testing? Yes, precisely. There is a general technique for defining the for constructing the Hilbert product. I'm hesitating because there are two levels at which I can answer. In the framework of the Hamiltonian formalism, then the problem is open in the sense that we should know more about the space of solutions of the constraint before starting making the machinery work. In the covariant formalism, the expectation value of the projector operator gives essentially the physical Hilbert product, physical meaning on the space, on the physical Hilbert space. But there we may expect to see the divergences coming in because term by term here everything is finite, but the sum of the spin form, it's likely to diverge or might very well diverge. So I have a formal expression for the this Hilbert product in the covariant approach where there's still the divergences of the sum. In the canonical approach, I have a technology for constructing it, but not yet the definition.
I mean, just very quickly, Bob, I mean, one might have expected that you'd need a just completely different inner product, not some small modification, you know, or not some fix-up like going to the dual or something like that. I mean, just, you know, because in the parameterized particle model, one, I would think that this is the inner product that you're dealing with is kind of like integrating over time as well as space to define some sort of L2 inner product. I mean, you know, just getting back to the, you know, old problem of time and you know, what is the meaning of these states and how would you normalize them? One might have expected that when the Hamiltonian constraint is properly dealt with, one would go to some totally different inner product. I mean, I don't know whether there are any hints of this in what you're doing or whether you have any comment on this or whether my remark is even in the right ballpark or relevant ballpark of anything.
Well, yes, but there's a general strategy for writing this such Hilbert product. This is the same one used for going from the big kinematical space to the diffeomorphic invariant. There's a precise requirement on this Hilbert product, which is that the self-adjoint operators up there, which are well-defined on the smaller Hilbert space, be self-adjoint in the smaller Hilbert space. So there's a rule. And whether we can actually apply this rule or not, it's a matter of how good we are with math. But the rule is there, and the rule works for the parameterized particle. If I take the parameterized formulation of the particle with this constraint, and I look, for instance, this is a particular example, of the observables which commute with the constraint, which are defined and which are self-adjoint up there, and I require them to be self-adjoint down there, then this fixes uniquely, actually, this particular set is sufficient in that particular case, fixes uniquely a physical Hilbert product, which is the correct one, the right one in the particle. This is one way of viewing the. I mean, Bob, you know better than me the huge literature that there is on the ways of constructing the Hilbert product on the space of solutions of constraints of that sort. But this is one way of doing this, and this fixes a Hilbert product uniquely, and it's the correct one. So the idea is using the same technology.
Good. So if I understood your sort of regularization procedure for the Hamiltonian constraint, you could have ignored epsilon altogether, simply point split and stops. Right? You just say you separate the points, and then you just define the operator that way with the separated points, and you feel good about it because of diffeomorphism invariance. But in the definition, that's all you're doing. You're really just point splitting, and you never need to use epsilon. Is that correct?
Yes, I mean, yes, I mean,
okay,
yeah. Forgetting a lot of technicalities, which are, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So that means that if you couple this to any matter theory, even badly divergent, non-renormalizable matter, you would expect it all to be finite.
Yes, absolutely, which does not mean that this is a way, does not mean that this gives a finite QCD by itself, right, in any sense. What happens is that the typical thing that happens is, can I write on the blackboard? Is that readable? is that if I take, for instance, the electric term in the Young-Mills Hamiltonian, this gives some divergence when I write the corresponding Hamiltonian, the corresponding quantum operator, roughly because this is a distribution that gives a delta of zero. This gives another delta of zero. This is an integral in d3x. That's infinite. Now, what we're doing here is that remembering that there is the gravitational degrees of freedom, not a background metric. So it's really the metric sitting here, and this is a density, this is a density, so actually there is the square root of q sitting here. If you now make all of these operators, you discover that this goes as delta of 0, this goes as delta of 0, and this goes as 1 over delta of 0, okay? Which when you integrate is finite. So physically what goes on is that if you want if you do perturbation theory with that, you get the infinities from the extremely high frequency. These are the ultraviolet divergences we're talking about. The extremely high frequencies mode of the Young-Mills field. But the state that we write here, the Young-Mills field sits on these spin networks, which are Planck length separated one from the other. So there are no high energy modes. So the quantum, the gravitational thing, which is the gravitational. The Planck length cut off the Young-Mills theory, which is the old hope in quantum gravity somehow, and we see this somehow happening here in this way. This term has been constructed in detail with this technology, and it is actually finite. It's work by Timon on that.
Next question. In the transformations which you considered in calculating your amplitudes, you seemed only to consider actions which create edges and none which remove them. This seems to lead to a breaking of a time reversal symmetry in the theory. And the tension seems to arise between it and the locality which you enforce by having these things operate only at vertices. As a physicist, how do you suppose this could be resolved?
Maybe I should stop you because it was really a simplification for presentation matters. In the construction of the Hamiltonian, I skipped various steps, including a symmetrization. So there is a action of the Hamiltonian opposite of that. There's a term of the Hamiltonian that brings the time reversal is also a matrix element of the Hamiltonian.
And does that violate locality?
No. No, no, absolutely. It's still, well, locality in that particular sense that I said, the answer is no. It's still true that, well, the same picture.
What's the amplitudes for collapsing a triangle that was the size of our galaxy down to a vertex?
Well, the triangles don't have size.
Well, presumably,
in some given area,
have to figure.
Well, I think that this is sufficiently uncharted territory that we should look at the formalism and then see which part of our intuition holds and which parts do not hold. This kind of question that we are raising are constant questions that one asks himself in doing this kind of thing. So you, there are some things that happen that seems unnatural, then they are not once you look at it. The answer that John was giving you is precisely the right answer. Locality here is the same as before, namely this matrix element of the Hamiltonian the other way around does not depend on what happens outside. So if you want the spin network, in the spin form, the edges come branch off, but it can also come together, and the amplitude of this happening does not depend on what happens.
So I'd like to get in one last question before we break.
Okay, I have two comments and five questions.
Well, we'll break.
So I'll just make one comment and ask one question. The comment is, it seems to me the Hartle-Hawking path integral, although it does give you a state that's in the kernel of the Wheeler-DeWitt constraint, it's not a projection operator, quite clearly. So I think there's a flaw in that analogy. The other thing is, you proposed using the generalized quantum mechanics as maybe a route to interpreting the spin foam quantum mechanics. Has there been any work done in looking at whether or not the axioms that really make that generalized quantum mechanics into a physical theory are satisfied by the spin foam path integral?
Okay. The first question is the fact that the P defined by the Hawkins integral is not a projector, nor is this a projector. I use the expression projector. I should have said that. This is clearly discussed in the papers. It's not really a projector. It's a mapping between two different spaces, which are not sitting inside each other. So it would be a projector. The analogous thing in finite degrees of freedom quantum mechanics is a projector. But so the same pathologies appear here, if I understand what you were referring to. So the analogy holds. The world projector is probably badly chosen. As far as the second question is concerned, the answer is not yet. It's there's work in progress. I suppose that the answer is yes, but it's a supposition. I don't know. I haven't checked all the axioms in detail. Also because there are a
the construct of the decoding function, will that you don't need all the amplitudes or some really big property of the amplitudes? So would it be quite difficult to really check?
I don't know. We should ask Jim maybe. You can directly give the decoding amplitude, the decoding functional, or you can get it from an amplitude on each individual. Okay, this is a shortcut. Okay, so maybe Jim.
So we'll get an authoritative statement from Jim and then probably close.
Ooh, what a pleasure. I think as long as you can construct amplitudes for histories and combine them, right, in the usual ways, in the sense that you've got interproducts in the Hilbert space, there'd be no problem constructing a decoherence functional which satisfies the very simple axioms of positivity, superposition, and so forth. It's sort of built into into path integral constructions that that would be true. So I'd be surprised if there was a difficulty.
Okay, I'm sure there's a lot more things we should discuss here, but we'll stop and continue discussions in private and in public on the beach this afternoon. Coffee is out here, of course, and let me remind you again that if you please make sure you have a name tag, either your original one or a replacement you can get out here before going down to the beach for the barbecue at lunchtime. Thanks.